Batman number 479, early June 1992. After having been missing for a week, a banker in his 20s named Frank Buick was found nearly dead by the Batman. Buick's nude body showed clear signs of torture, and he was discovered with his feet and hands bound by rope, dangling in a crucifix pose from a fire escape. After receiving care at a hospital, Buick displayed emotional trauma and feigned memory loss when questioned about his captors. Buick also fearfully demanded he be tended to by a male nurse, and later tried to contact his friend Peter Langan, but got an answering machine.
"You've got to call me. It's urgent. You could be killed."
Batman had run a feint of his own, pretending to have left while secretly observing Buick's actions. While driving home from a club, yuppie Peter Langan was run off the road by a pickup truck. The driver proved to be a statuesque blonde with an Amazonian build, clad in skimpy brown leather from mask to sandals. Langan went from mad to lecherous at the sight of her, but the woman made clear,
"I dress to please myself, and I'm far from sorry,"
with a kick in the face. As Langan was judo thrown against the wall, he learned,
"The name is Pagan, and you are your kind, and show me nothing at all."
Batman had determined Langan's path from the club to his penthouse with the help of a doorman, but caught sight of the wrecked sports car en route. The Dark Knight detective could tell from the point of impact that a light-colored truck was likely involved and had been damaged in the crash, based on the trail of oil it left behind. Pagan had taken Peter Langan to an abandoned warehouse, where she began battering him physically and verbally.
"Scream while you like, Peter, and we'll hear you. Beg? That must be hard for such a macho man, Peter. Not very nice when someone makes you plead, now is it? Makes you sick when you realize they have all the power and you have none, doesn't it? Especially when they ignore your pleas."
Pagan was disappointed Langan fainted after fewer blows than Buick, but
"I'll be here when you wake up."
Batman found the abandoned truck and determined from footprints that the female assailant had switched vehicles. From the Batmobile, he called Lieutenant Kitch, the investigator on the case. As a favor, Kitch cross-referenced Buick and Langan in the police records and found they had both walked on an assault and battery charge against a girl a couple of years back. Pagan tossed a bucket of water on Langan, and his beating continued.
"You know why I'm doing this, don't you, Peter? Remember Sandra?"
Langan did, as a drunken accident.
"Beating a 17-year-old girl unconscious was an accident?"
Pagan believed the male judge in the case was guaranteed to side with the wealthy yuppies over an also-drunk teenager.
"You left scars that could never heal. You stole her life. I want to teach you what it's like, Peter."
Batman met Sandra Mercer's parents, who explained their daughter was a vivacious, friendly girl everyone loved before those animals destroyed their entire family. Sandra couldn't even stand to be near her father anymore, while Langan and Buick got off scot-free. The Dark Knight wanted to know where he could find Sandra now.
"Is this some kind of joke? Sandra committed suicide a week after the trial."
Pagan made Langan cry out the same plea Sandra made to him.
"Please don't hurt me. Let me go. I won't tell anyone if you just let me go."
The men hadn't listened then, so why would Pagan now? Just as she pulled a knife, Batman found the pair, and a batarang disarmed Pagan. Batman tried to get through to Marion Mercer, the sister who felt she had died with Sandra, but couldn't get past the vengeful Pagan. The man-hating vigilante had some solid moves, but she wasn't full enough to take on Batman, and instead leapt out a 6-story window to a waiting guide wire. Sliding down to a motorcycle she had stashed, Pagan shouted back,
"You haven't heard the last of me. Gotham's a man city. It needs a woman to redress the balance. I'll be back."
Batman expected Pagan might escape, and took the time to chain the back wheel of her chopper before rescuing Langan. Pagan was thrown off the bike and knocked unconscious. Langan began to thank the Batman.
"You have no reason to thank me, Mr. Langan. I'm handing you over to the police. And one more thing, don't ever thank me again."
Pagan was by Alan Grant and Tom Mandrake. I'm not sure what Batman intended to turn Langan over to the police for, as double jeopardy would prevent revisitation of the assault charge. Maybe Peter had confessed to raping Sandra, but that was left ambiguous, and would be damn tough to prove in court. I believe it's also worth sharing that I saw an awful lot of parallels between this story and the plot to the fourth Clint Eastwood Dirty Harry picture Sudden Impact, in which Sandra Locke played the vigilante.
Like a very special episode of Blossom, I believe that comic books, despite being a juvenile medium, especially in this time period, is capable of approaching important, mature topics and educating its audience. However, in a code-approved comic book from 1992, where phrases like sexual assault can't even be uttered, and with a new scantily clad heroine who appears to inflict the same sort of violating trauma upon admittedly guilty parties as they themselves had perpetrated, I'm thinking a sensitive discussion is fairly impossible when the storyteller's main influences and source of information seems to be Lady 45 or I Spit on Your Grave. Possibly despite good intentions, it's very difficult not to see this story as exploitative, especially when the artist Tom Mandrake insists on drawing Pagan with a thong that's so revealing, especially when she's doing her acrobatics and martial arts moves, that the colorist took the liberty of giving her purple tights on the cover to at least downplay that element, which is very much prominent inside the book itself. It also doesn't help that Pagan is a fairly cartoonish misandrist, which feeds into stereotypes perpetuated by men's rights activists and the like. Pagan is very much a straw feminist, and in her debut appearance parents not very appealing or believable. At the same time, though, I actually kind of like her costume design. I like the art. She does kick butt. She is very capable. So if you can find some way to dance around that core issue and to give her a greater sense of humanity and a personality as opposed to just spouting rhetoric, I actually wouldn't mind reading some more stories with Pagan. I'm thinking maybe let a woman write it, though. But the thing of it is, this is a character that made two appearances and has not been seen in about 23 years, so I doubt that anybody's going to take the initiative to change that anytime soon.
Starting in December 2015,
a new epic mega series,
Trennis Magnus Punches Reality,
proudly presents
Batman v Superman,
a 13-part miniseries from Trennis Magnus Punches Reality. John M. Wilson
and Magnus
shine a spotlight on a crapload of Batman comics
and a crapload of Superman comics,
all as preparation for the theatrical release of
Batman v Superman,
Dawn of Justice.
And once that's all over,
we'll take a five-hour-long look back at 2013's Man of Steel.
Finally, we will come together again to discuss our thoughts on the Batman v Superman film.
So join Magnus and John as they recount the adventures of Batman and Superman in comics.
All as preparation for Batman and Superman's first adventure
in live-action feature film.
The adventure begins in
December 2015.
Batman v Superman.
Only at TwoTrueFreaks.com. Batman vs. Superman, a 13-part miniseries from Trennis Magnus Punches Reality.
Only at TwoTrueFreaks.com.
Batman, Shadow of the Bat, Annual Number 1, 1993, Chapter 1, Joe Public. A loose older woman was in a bar talking to an exotic-looking man, very tall, with flowing blonde hair. He introduces himself as Gordon Reed, and the lady feels that she knows him well enough to invite him out to another bar, someplace a little more happening. In a back alley, Gordon's hair suddenly seems to turn to a yellow flame, lifting above his head, and then he transformed into a bat-like thing of the damned. In truth, he is Gamir, one of the alien bloodline's parasites, and the woman, sadly, is soon a statistic. Scene change to another Gotham City back alley. Batman confronts a punk, bald-headed, wearing new wave shades, brandishing a knife.
Stay back or I swear I'll slit your throat. I'm betting you won't shades. Not because I don't think you're rotten enough or cowardly enough to hurt a woman, but because I happen to know from your police files, Darlene Tibbs is your girlfriend.
Batman not only takes out shades, but manages to avoid the knife directed toward his back by Darlene. Both parties are taken into custody, as well as a briefcase full of money. Not quite full enough, though. Shades has been holding the money for Happy Jack, but one night he got drunk and hit the casinos, and now the stash was about half what it should be. As it turned out, getting busted by Batman was going to be something of a lucky break for him. Batman took off Shades' shades and put them on over his own cowled eyes.
You tell me where to find Happy Jack, and I'll take all the heat off you.
At the South End Marina, in the freezing cold, two guards stand on a small boat, awaiting Shades' arrival. One of the guards looks up and sees a large bat-like image against the moonlight. It had to be a trick of the light, right? Gamir is carrying the woman's corpse to a secluded island. There's some form of bunker there, where he's holding living captives, as well as stashing the dead, sacrificed to his appetites. Gamir arrives in his partially human form, hair aflame, and his captives feel like they ought to do something, but they can't quite bring themselves to move. And just as suddenly as Gamir had arrived, he'd left again, back at the marina.
Greed is a virus that infects mankind. Greed is why millions die of famine, while a few eat like pigs. It's why our greatest minds are set to work on weapons of mass destruction. Why half the world is addicted to nicotine, why they close hospitals and build malls. We want, and when we get what we want more, and even more is never enough. We aspire to the stars, but greed keeps us firmly in the dirt, and they don't get any greedier than Happy Jack. Well, not tonight. That's his dope, which just arrived. I knew if I hung around long enough, something would happen. Sal arrived with the drugs, and soon Shades followed with the money. At least 6 of them now, and probably all armed. Maybe I should wait, let the deal go down, and try to take Jack after the others leave. Or maybe I should call the cops. But which time Jack's cronies might get away to dump another load of death in Gotham schools. No, I swore on Tommy's grave I'd do it tonight. I can't back out now. I have to do it. Whatever happens, I have to.
Standing on a building overlooking the marina, Joe Public is near silhouetted in the moonlight. He has a yellow flat top, enormous silver reflective sunglasses, a black leather jacket with an American eagle and a sort of Captain America looking shield on the chest. Metal 5-pointed stars dangle from his shoulders, about the size of a pie plate. He wears leather gloves, combat boots, and parachute pants. Maybe denim, loose fitting. This man, this vigilante, is Joe Public. Back on the boat, the men meet with Happy Jack.
I'm Gotham's biggest wheel, a rich, rich man, and I'm smaller than the kids who buy my stuff. Now, ain't that a hoot?
Happy Jack was an older man, white hair, gaunt face, hooked nose, wearing a black suit jacket with tie, white shirt, white pants. He appeared to suffer from some form of dwarfism, standing probably about 4 feet tall. While Happy Jack inspects the 20,000 tablets of ecstasy he's about to buy, Shades has knocked out one of Happy Jack's men and begins to take off his disguise to reveal the Batman. Topside, Joe Public knocks out one of Happy Jack's men and takes what appears to be an M16 from him.
I couldn't use one of these if I was paid to, but Jack and his mob needn't know that.
Caught in possession. The laugh's on you, Jack.
Batman!
All of you, hold it. This is a citizen's arrest. Batman, but how did you...
As it happens, Happy Jack was carrying an electricity gun, which manages to knock out both Batman and Joe Public. Happy Jack and his associates make a break for it, running off the boat and into an alley. Sal, a man with a briefcase full of ecstasy, gets caught by Gamir in his bat form, who merely swoops down and snatches him up and flies away. The briefcase falls from his grasp, but Happy Jack doesn't have time to find it before our heroes could potentially recover. Well, hero. Batman condemns Joe Public as an amateur and tells him to stop with the vigilantism because he's no blasted good at it. And Happy Jack's made good his escape.
I spent weeks tracking down Jack. I'll owe him for a half dozen ruined lives. Batman, no, I'm not giving up now.
End chapter one.
Hey everybody, my name is Michael Bailey, and this is the trailer with a truly epic ending to my new show about Batman, appropriately titled Bailey's Batman Podcast. Bailey's Batman Podcast is a weekly program that looks at a month in the life of the Dark Knight Detective, starting with the books bearing a March 1983 cover date, which is where my solid run of the character's comics begins, and moving forward until, well, at least until the books that came out in 2005, because that's where the solid run ends. Each week, I will give you a full synopsis and review of every major ongoing Batman title, with brief stops along the way to look at the important specials, miniseries, one-shots, and Elseworld stories, just to keep things interesting. I'll also be telling you what other books Batman appeared in that month, as well as what was going on elsewhere in the DCU. It is going to be all Batman, all the time, as I look at over 20 years of the character's history. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the epic ending to this trailer. You ready? The first appearance of Jason Todd. Death in the Family. Nightfall. Epic. No Man's Land. Do you have chills yet? All of that and more will be covered on Bailey's Batman Podcast every Tuesday at baileysbatmanpodcast.com.
Chapter 2. Pagan. A blonde-haired woman walks down the wrong back street in Gotham City, dressed in a long brown trench coat. A group of men begin harassing her.
What's the hurry, sister? All rush and no fun makes Jill a dull girl.
Batman swoops in.
Step away from her, now!
But out, Batman. Pagan doesn't need any man to fight her battles.
She proceeds to kick the hell out of the lot of them.
So you're back on the streets. I read you'd been acquitted of your attack on those two men.
The jury said I was justified. Those animals drove my sister to her death. I vowed then to help the women of this city against the beasts that prey on them. That's why Marion Mercer became Pagan. It's a vow I'll keep till I go to my grave.
I wonder what a jury would say to this.
Beating up three thugs who threatened me? Thugs you'd have beaten up if I hadn't? Give me a break, Batman. They'd award me a medal.
Both vigilantes were hunting the slasher that had been stalking Gotham in recent weeks. Pagan had been setting herself up as bait, but clearly had captured more mundane prey. She expected Batman to give her the brush off, but the Dark Knight detective actually recognized that she was capable and saw no point in covering the same ground on parallel investigations. Take a ride in the Batmobile. Back on the island, Gamir brought back another victim to his bunker. One of his captors finally saw his chance and tackled Gamir by the knees. Others soon joined in.
Primitive and furious scum! You should be honored by the chance to serve me. Joyous that your worthless, insignificant lives have found a purpose in the sustenance of your betters. I like spirit in my beasts. I have a special use for you. Your pain is but a fleeting thing. What you will provide is eternal.
Gamir took the man who had shown initiative and sucked the juice out of his spinal column. Back in Gotham, Batman and Pagan found the ravaged, bloody body of the ecstasy dealer. Based on blood spatters in the area, Batman determined that he'd been killed in the air. Their assailant was a flyer. Meanwhile, Happy Jack had returned to the scene of Sal's abduction. Joe Public thought that might happen. He'd already come around to find the briefcase and was waiting for Happy Jack to make his move.
This what you're looking for, scumball? I knew your greed would bring you back. Bloodsucker. Peddling dope to school kids. You ought to be executed as a favor to humanity.
6 foot plus, well-built Joe Public then proceeded to slug a little person in the mouth.
Don't know what your gripe is, pal, but you lecture like a teacher and you fight like one too.
Once again, Joe Public fell victim to the electricity gun.
Twice in one night. Who the hell are you?
I am a teacher. Phys Ed at Gotham High. A bunch of my seniors went to a party. They bought E to help them dance the night away. From one of your pushers. One of them, Tommy Vance, had a weak heart. The effects of the drug were too much. He died.
Yeah, the cops hassled my men on that one. Too bad they no proof, huh, Teach? Guess you thought you'd succeed where they failed. Well, third time unlucky.
Happy Jack set Phaser to kill, but before he could pull the trigger, Gamir came around and picked up a light snack. Batman and Pagan were close enough to the area to see it happen, and Batman began to calculate the trajectory, determining Gamir's destination. Pagan wasn't happy about being left behind, as Batman ascended a fire escape to the top of a tall building, but you see his bat hang glider could only carry one person, and he had to make it all the way to Blackgate Island in a hurry. I assume this was before the prison had been built. Pagan liked Batman's style, but going solo was just like a man, and she wasn't going to have it. She wasted the marina, found a speedboat, and started making her way in pursuit. Gamir had already suckled Happy Jack to death, but Joe Public had joined the ride, and Gamir was hungry again. Joe Public tried to hit the alien with a tree branch, and it did no good. Its grotesque, tentacled tongue flew out of its mouth and into Joe Public's, draining his spinal fluid from the inside. A disturbing, violating, lethal French kiss that left gore from Joe Public's own body dripping down his face. In Chapter 2.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Prom, the host of Comic Reflections, a podcast devoted to Silver and Bronze Age comics. Join me and my spunky sidekicks, Jeff Barnhart, the crusty curmudgeon from Dogpatch USA, and Spencer Valadez, podcasting's very own Apache Chief, as we discuss the grooviest comic books of yesteryear. You'll find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and at comicreflections.wordpress.com. What are you waiting for? Tune in, turn on, and kick ass!
Chapter 3. Greed. Gamir was returning to Gotham from the island and was caught midair by Batman's hang glider. The glider did not fare well in the collision. Batman was soon left falling to the earth, while Pagan could only watch from her speedboat. Batman rolled with a thump and then began evening the odds with his utility belt. Phosphor flares. A sort of heavy-duty bolo. Batarang. None occupied Gamir for long. Gamir slapped Batman, leaving him lying face down on the ground. Just then Pagan arrived, and her martial arts moves were able to at least distract Gamir temporarily. She had a bolo of her own, which was able to clamp shut Gamir's mouth temporarily. The pair evacuated the area, stumbling upon the bodies of Happy Jack and Joe Public. Well, the former body of Joe Public. As it happened, he was suddenly alive again. They drug his unconscious form to the bunker, where they found a ventilation shaft and began crawling through. Gamir tore into the building, but the cramped spaces were too tight for him to reach. The vent led to the holding cell, where Batman briefly questioned the captives. Gamir, in his full human form, very swiftly opened the door.
Greetings. Welcome to my larder.
It's him! The monster! It's him!
Monster and insult worm. I knew my depredations would attract attention sooner or later, but I couldn't resist. You humans are primitive, inferior, but you taste so exquisite. I'm afraid I let my greed get the better of me. And now, well, I'll just have to move on. Once I've consumed you all, of course.
Batman invites Gamir to consume his fist, but it doesn't play out very well. Despite his human appearance, Gamir is still a physical powerhouse. He backhands the Batman across the room and easily catches Pagan's fist in the palm of of his hand.
No more poor struggling primitives. Your fight is over, and after the battle, the victors feast.
Just then, Joe Public roused. I have to do something, help them somehow, but I feel so weak. No, I can't let it destroy them. I won't let it. I won't! Suddenly, all the humans in the area felt terribly weak, barely able to move, including Batman and Pagan. However, Joe Public was now superhumanly strong, punching Gamir through a wall. Gamir's whipping tail slapped Joe Public, but it didn't even hurt.
I don't believe this. When I saw him earlier, he fought like an amateur. He didn't have anything like that kind of power.
Gamir caught Joe Public by the arm and began flying off with him. The alien's claws dug into Joe Public's skin, causing streams of blood to run down his arm. Desperately, Joe Public reached for one of his shoulder stars and flung it like a ninja, catching Gamir in the shoulder. The pain caused Gamir to let Joe Public go, and he fell back to the island. Gamir did not turn back, flying off to find a new hunting ground. Batman and Pagan teamed up to catch Joe Public, and then asked if he was all right.
I don't know what came over me. One second I was so weak, and then I felt so strong, I almost exploded.
I wonder. At the same time you were filled with power, Pagan and I, those other people, became so weak we could hardly stand. Almost as if you absorbed our strength.
I don't know anything about stuff like that. I'm just a phys ed teacher from the east side. And after tonight's drama, you can bet that's where I'm heading back. In the future, I'll leave crime to professionals.
A monster that can change into a man. I wonder where it came from, what it wanted.
I'm more concerned about where it's headed and how many will die once it gets there.
In Chapter 3. Despite dealing with corpses and horrific circumstances, somehow the annual is a bit more savory than Pagan's first appearance, and she's handled with a slightly dialed down personality so that you could almost call her a heroine instead of someone who's in some ways as bad as the people that she was going after, at least in that initial instance. Somebody might try to argue that when she beats up the group of men, she's making assumptions about their intentions, but the fact is, if Batman was swinging down and about ready to kick their butts, I think that we need to give Pagan the benefit of the doubt and assume that she could also tell whether or not she was in a truly dangerous situation that required her to assault the hell out of some people. The Shadow of the Bat annual works a lot better as a story than Pagan's first appearance. It works very well within the confines of the horror genre that the Bloodlines annual seemed to be targeting. In the specific case of Gamir with his bat wings and his haughty attitude, and my presuming he has some sort of British-ish accent, I got a lot of imagery in this book that recalled the movie Life Force and the giant bat aliens that appeared in that. Being fond of that bit of trash cinema, it was a nice little callback for me. The art is by Trevor Von Eden, and I love his classic style, not the Black Lightning era, but the early 80s onto the mid 80s, where he did a more angular, somewhat minimalist style. It's just so cool. It's so 80s. Even as he's drawing what appears to be a mutant from the 1986 book, The Dark Knight Returns, almost a decade too late, because it's Von Eden, he sells it. And prior to this, Von Eden had been working on the Black Canary series, where he had appeared to try to ape elements of Frank Miller's art on Sin City and failed in a pretty spectacular fashion. He had a nasty tendency to draw these bloated balloon people. What I love about this annual is he goes back to a much more lean, precise style. One of my favorite Batman comics of all time was one of the first I ever bought, the Batman Annual number 8, which Von Eden drew magnificently. And I love his interpretation of Batman. He also does a great job on Pagan. She's still in the same costume, but he draws her with a little bit less liberal inclinations toward the showing of flesh. She just looks like an athlete. She looks natural in the suit. She looks like the sort of suit you'd wear if you were an Olympian. And because Von Eden has a greater tendency toward a design aesthetic in his work, things like the female symbol over Pagan's eye look better. It fits better. Everything's balanced out more strongly. You've also got an early example of computer coloring from Adrienne Roy, and I think it works very well with the artwork. It's much more blocky. The gradients are much more obvious, but that slightly artificial quality actually works well for this story because of the way it's drawn. And I like little touches like the way Gamir's wings are semi-translucent so that when it flies near the moon, you can see the light of the moon piercing through his wings. Or in other instances, you can see veins running through his body. I liked how you'd have streaks of darker colors running through the night skies. Computer coloring has gotten so advanced at this point that it's somewhat overwhelming. It seems like it turns a lot of comic books into quasi CG creations. You lose the sense of this being a drawing that's been colored. It sort of absorbs the line work into a larger whole that's more replicated in other media. I tend to like my comics to look like comics. I like it when it looks like a drawing. I like it when the colors are a little bit flatter. And I like when there's clear stylistic choices, not just trying to make comics look as much like video games as possible. So I look at this and I think that this is what they were trying to do on books like The Dark Knight Strikes Back and failing miserably, even though the computer technology had advanced. advance a whole decade from this point. So it's a great looking book. It reads well. You've got a pretty nifty new character in Pagan. But oh yeah, Joe Public. Joe Public sucks. He's terribly designed. He looks like a mockery of an American style superhero. My understanding is that Alan Grant designed him with Norm Brayfogle, and he somehow reeks of the worst of both the 90s and the 1980s. It doesn't help that he's running around spouting a lot of Reagan era anti-drug propaganda. When I flash back to the drug lectures I got in school, it makes me mad because they taught me things that were demonstrably false. I especially take umbrage with them telling me that you could smoke pot and then 10 years later the pot will have settled in your reproductive organs and you're gonna have deformed children. I don't think it's cool to lie to children like that. Me personally though, I actually just said no. I've never been big on drugs. I've hardly ever done anything along those lines. I'm not a big drinker either, but that's my choice. Don't tell me a bunch of fibs like geriatric leprechauns are trying to hook second graders on smack, because second graders don't have any money.
They have no liquid assets. You ever seen a grade schooler try to hit a vein? Their little fingers can't work a syringe worth a damn. They can't work a tourniquet, nothing. Forget about it. It's a complete fantasy.
Finally, this issue features an alternate version of the cover drawn by Christian Alami, the fellow who had illustrated the initial annual and who did a lot of the promotional artwork for Bloodlines, the stuff that Art Adams didn't do as part of his designing the characters in the first place. I suspect that the intention was that Alami was going to draw more of these covers, but as I mentioned in a previous podcast, I don't think he was fast enough to knock out, I don't know, 20-some-odd, 30-some-odd covers in the span of a summer. It's not a bad-looking cover, and again, I'm not sure which came first, Alami's or Brian Stelfreeze's, but Brian Stelfreeze was the regular cover artist for Batman Shadow of the Bat. He gives the image a much more striking design, a much more striking layout, and his style much better complements the interiors by Trevor Von Eden, so I think they made the right choice in changing up the cover. But overall, this is one of the better Bloodlines annuals. I enjoyed it. I liked everything about it but that idiot Joe Public, and I'd recommend checking it out.
Sawate. My name is Stella, and I am the host of Backroll to Oracle, the Barbara Gordon podcast. Backroll to Oracle is a podcast dedicated to Barbara Gordon, the first woman to hold the mantle of Backroll for an extended period of time, roughly 1967 to 1988. The goal of Backroll to Oracle is to examine the character's history from her first appearance as Batgirl and continuing through her tenure as Oracle. Each episode looks at a vintage issue of Detective Comics or Batman, as well as other books like Justice League and Freedom Fighters, and modern issues of Batgirl and Birds of Prey. I also keep track of news involving Batgirl and other members of the Bat family, and I have a revolving series of segments like Babs in the Tube, which highlights appearances of Babs in TV and film, Shipper Spotlight, which looks at a variety of comic and pop culture couples, gives their history, and determines whether they are hot or not. Reading with Stella, which could be described as an audio drama, or just me reading a book that relates to Babs or doesn't. And of course, the mainstay literature recommendation. I have been blessed to interview writers Scott Beatty and Chuck Dixon on their Batgirl Year One work, Brian Q. Miller on his Batgirl run, Dwayne Swierczynski and Christy Marks on their separate Birds of Prey work, and the creators and actors of the Batgirl Spoiled, the web series. I hope to interview more creators and actors in the future. My goal, most importantly, is to make a fun, entertaining, and thoughtful show that people enjoy and from which they learn. Find the show online at thebatmanuniverse.net and iTunes, and follow the show on Facebook and Twitter at Batgirl to Oracle. Thank you, and fly on, Babs lovers.
To the delight of no one, Joe Public returned in 1994 as Batman Shadow of the Bat number 25. In a Night Quest the Crusade chapter, Jean-Paul Valley, the vigilante zealot better known as Azrael, acted as the replacement Batman. Operating in an armored suit, dubbed in fan circles Azbat, Valley criticized Joe Public's handling of a gang-related confrontation. Azbat told Joe to just quit, and he seriously considered it, but he ultimately proved something resembling helpful in a battle with the Corrosive Man. Later that year, Joe Public turned up in Justice League Task Force No. 9. In a confrontation with Hoods where innocent lives were imperiled, Joe Public bungled the situation once again and had to be saved by Geist. Neither of the heroes think they're particularly good at what they do, so they decide to go on a road trip from Gotham to New York City and petition Martian Manhunter to train them. John Jones is only willing to allot them 5 minutes, which is enough time for them to be attacked by a new blood I forgot existed, and to be joined in battle by Loose Cannon. Joe Public actually does play a key role in defeating the Big Bad. The final appearance of both Pagan and Joe Public was in 1996's Batman Shadow of the Bat number 50. Narcosis, feeling victimized by Gotham's foster care system, took out his anger on the entire city by attempting to drug its citizens into a lucid dreaming state. The more pseudoscientifically plausible but originality poor man Scarecrow tried his mixture on Batman first. The Dark Knight called on hallucinatory visions of Pagan, Joe Public, and others to overcome the effects and defeat the villain. Narcosis made 5 total appearances, all written by Alan Grant in Shadow of the Bat, before appearing to perish thanks to the Mad Hatter. Okay, I've just had the worst work night of an already bad week. It's not quite 2:30 in the morning as I record this. I've been home for less than half an hour, but I promised I'd get a show out on Thursday, and that's what we're going for. Just excuse me if I'm a little punchy. If you enjoy the music that played as an undercurrent throughout this episode, I'd recommend you legally download them through your MP3 provider of choice. The songs include New Wave Polly, Mark Goodear Session by Nirvana, Asking For It by Hole, Easy Come, Easy Go by Joe Public, Live and Learn by Joe Public, Pagan Poetry by Bjork, and No Sympathy from the Devil by Public Enemy. We received sweet, sweet social media love from the 108th Sage, Alan Middleton, Andrew Leyland, Ange, Between the Pages, Bill Bear at Gotham Knight 13, Brian Mulvey, the BS Podcast Network, Cash Flag, Chris Sheehan, Coffee and Comics Blog, Comic Reflections, Darren and Ruth Sutherland, David Fior, D. Sugar, Ed Moore and Ed Moore Jr., at Indie Comics Fan, at TL Productions, at Miskatonic, Fangirl Nation, FKA Jason, Geek Girl Ruby Kane, Hicks, James Zaif, Joseph Crawford, who also put us on a list of Follow Friday great podcasters, thank you for that, Keith G. Baker, King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun Podcast, Mark Sweeney, Mike Zumo, Paul Scavito, Richard Field, Scott Bachman, Silver and Gold Podcast, Celebrating Booster Gold and Captain Atom, Siskoid, Son of Cthulhu, Super Friend Super Show, Senate Alias Scarecrow, Two Dangers for a Girl Blog, Trekker Talk, who also listed us in their Follow Friday Insightful Reviews and Discussion List, Gracias, Waffle Danvers, Warlord Worlds, and Weird Science DC. Martin Gray wrote of Layla, she looks like a cross between Mind Boggler and Lobo. That's correct. Paul Hicks wrote, I get the impression Layla would be much more at home in the 2080 universe. That's probably my subconscious reacting to Alan Grant's involvement. Good art, lots of setup, story, wasted character, next. Yeah, no, I don't disagree with you. I think I'm feeling the same vibe as you. James Zaif wrote of the Outbreak episode, Bloodlines was bad when they originally came up with the idea. There's no way this is going to be any better except maybe for the art. Presumably referring to the New 52 miniseries that hasn't quite gotten to me yet. I'm waiting for it in the mail. Clinton Robinson wrote of the Outbreak episode, leave it to Frank to track down my old Twitter account that never gets used anymore. Proves the man does his research, yes? Except for the part that I never connected Clinton Robinson, whose name I've heard on a bunch of podcasts, with the Coffee and Comics blog that's been very supportive of Roll Spine podcasts. I cannot claim to be a master detective, sorry. He also wrote hashtag best event ever lives on year round. An honest and legitimate series look at Bloodlines? Only the brave or foolish Frank would dare. And thank goodness he did. So glad to hear somebody tackling this with an unsarcastic approach. Looking forward to more. Illegal Machine wrote, I don't know SH poo poo about DC Bloodlines, but the first half of this podcast is a great comic industry history lesson. Now, admittedly, he wrote that on our Rolled Spine podcast Facebook page, but I'm still going to take it as a compliment. Also, I want to apologize to the LMAC, who would probably like to see some more Rolled Spine podcasts about Marvel or involving himself and our good buddy, Mr. Fixit. It's just that the time it takes me to edit one of our 60 to 120 minute episodes, I can knock out 3 or 4 Bloodlines, and my work schedule has just been squashing me in recent weeks, so I figured this is better than nothing. And Civil War is coming up. We're definitely going to have an episode coming out about that. Paul Hicks of the Waiting for Doom podcast and of the Being Australian Human Beingness wrote of the Edge of Steel episode, sweet, a new Bloodlines podcast for my drive home. Clinton Robinson wrote the same episode, never realized this was released so close to Steel's first appearance. Gotta say, for a character who endured long after the reign of the Superman, he didn't start off too well, huh? Never really thought about the symbolism of the cape and all that. If it helps, he stopped hiding his face in later versions of the armor, and the DCAU version, DC Animated Universe, of Steel didn't wear a cape at all. I have mixed feelings about the cape. It feels very superfluous, but at the same time, knowing where John Henry Irons was coming from when he became Steel, it makes sense for the character. As far as DC revealing his face, I don't really get it. I'm not a fan of it.
I suppose the intention was to make sure that people knew, hey, look, we have a black superhero. But one of the things I loved about Steel from the get-go was that as drawn by his co-creator, John Bogdanov, there was no way of mistaking Steel for any other race but an African-American. He didn't need to be in color at all. You could see it right there on his face. It was beautifully rendered and unmistakable. So my feeling was always that if an artist is drawing Steel in his armor with his face fully covered and you can't tell there's a black man underneath there, they need to go look at some pictures of black people and figure out how to do it right. I've seen all the different variations of Steel's uniform. I like the one from later in his solo series' run, which I think crossed over into the character's usage in the JLA comic. But the ones that came after that, the ones with the open face, the dark side, what was it, like an Omega Imperiex armor, I think it was. He built it out of the shell of one of the Imperiexes. They just didn't work for me. They got too far away from who the character was. I got the sense of the man being lost inside the Inky Poo, especially in that armor. And yeah, for a character that I feel like DC was trying to push to show diversity in their line in general, but specifically amongst the Superman family, it kind of felt like they went cheap on the ongoing series. But I'm going to look at that in a later episode, go into more detail about that. No sense in belaboring it here. This episode's long enough. Ryan Daly of the Power of Fishnets and Secret Origins podcasts wrote, "I couldn't have been less interested in Superman in the early 90s until they killed him. I picked up the polybagged Adventures of Superman number 500 that set up the four replacement Supermen for the Reign of story arc. But the only one who appealed to me was the one who was quite obviously not the real Superman, Henry Johnson, aka John Henry Irons, aka Steel. I followed his early appearances in Superman the Man of Steel. His look was so damn cool. I saw the obvious Thor and Iron Man influences, but I also thought he looked like a heroic version of Dr. Doom. Plus, he was a strong black man, and that made him different than a lot of other heroes I saw at the time, and made him closer to some of my favorite G.I. Joes like Stalker and Roadblock. I read the first two issues of Steel when he got his own title. I liked them, but not enough to forego one of my precious X-Men titles to follow the series for good. Great episodes. If when you finish your Bloodlines coverage and wanted to do more with Steel, I would not object. I'm glad to hear that because I always wanted to do more with John Henry Irons when DC Bloodlines was just a blog. I never was able to find the time. I think I can make that work better as a podcast. And I'm telling you now, the last year or so of the Steel book, the run written by Christopher Priest, drawn by Dennis Cowan, I think is one of the best comic book runs, period. I think that Christopher Priest on Steel was superior to his work on Black Panther. It's just an excellent, excellent series, and I definitely want to cover that on the podcast. I think what it'll happen is we'll do one in the future that gives an overview of the first 3 years of that title, which I think is among the worst comics DC Comics has ever published. And then you get to that last 14 issues or so, which is among their best. Finally, And wrote, "I can't comment too much on Bloodlines, but I can talk about Steel. I thought the trilogy of Death of Superman, Funeral for a Friend, Reign of Superman improved as they came out. Reign was an interesting story, and I liked the idea of four people claiming the mantle of Superman. Of all of them, it was clear that Steel would have the most staying power. Cyborg turned evil. It's hard to write an arrogant Eradicator for too long without it feeling one note. And Super Warrior was a bit too trendy to last without ongoing changes. That left Steel as a regular guy inspired by Superman to do more. That'll do. In the end, he became the Iron Man of the DCU. Sometimes that can lead to lazy writing. We need a new device to beat an unbeatable foe. Let's get Steel. He can make anything." Those early issues of him trying to make up for his past sins of weapons making also reek of Stark. But putting it on the street level with gangs was a nice new wrinkle. At the time, I thought John Bogdanov's art was amateurish, too rough in comparison to the smooth look of Grummet, Geiss, and Jurgens on the other superbooks. Now I realize it was that difference that gave it vitality. It is the most memorable art because of that difference. Steel's later stories and solo book never rose to the power of his origin stuff. I did like his turn in Morrison's JLA. I obviously disagree with Ange about how good the book was as it went along, although I will say that Steel very much bottomed out toward the end of that first 3 years. I do have to acknowledge that Superboy was clearly the most successful of the reign, having lasted 100 issues or so, plus a lot of specials, miniseries, a spinoff title, which we'll address because guess what? One of the major stars of that spinoff title was a New Blood. I'm not actually looking forward to reading any Superboy and the Ravers. All right, starting with this episode, the show will be bi-weekly. The intention was always for it to be a bi-weekly, and I put a bunch of episodes in the can to make sure we'd stay on that schedule. As I mentioned before, things in my real life got out of hand, and so the only option was to run Bloodlines if we were going to have any Rollsbind podcasts at all. But coming up in May, I'm planning on rolling out some more Idlehead of Diablo podcasts, particularly related to the event JL May, which we're going to run a promo for right after we get done talking. But the goal is to run several episodes of The Idlehead next month, which will look at the various origin stories of the Justice League of America, and especially take a closer look at stories of John Jones that impacted on those origins in ways you may not know about. And we'll just list that under the header of JLA Origins. That'll be coming out at least twice in the month of May as a supplement to JL May. And then we'll work Bloodlines in on the opposing weeks. And now I'll give it over to Shag, who does an amazing job on comic book podcasts, given that he can't read, because JLA Year One came out in 1998, dude.
And when the evening comes, we smile.
In 1994, Mark Waid, Brian Augustine, and Barry Kitson began exploring the beginnings of the world's greatest superhero team over an epic 12-issue comic maxi series.
And yes, we've just begun.
That team was the Justice League of America, and that comic was JLA Year One. In 2016, 8 podcasts will come together to cover this series in a single month. That month is JL May.
Just the two of us, working together day to day, together, together.
Featuring the Fire and Water Podcast, The Power of Fishnets, Waiting for Doom, The Lantern Cast, Supermates Podcast, The Idlehead of Diabolu, Comic Reflections, and Views from the Long Box. Each podcast will cover one or two issues of JLA Year One, and then coverage will move from show to show. It all starts in the Fire and Water Podcast with issues 1 and 2.
Yes, we've just begun.
JL May, an epic month for an epic series. Available where you find all good podcasts.
The preceding DC Comics-related program is a non-profit fan production. Any copyrighted materials therein are believed covered under fair use, and no copyright infringement is intended. Please leave your comments on the DC Bloodlines blog, the Rollsbind Podcast's WordPress page, via email at emailofdiabolu@yahoo.com, or you can tweet the host directly on the Twitters at Commander Blanks, spelled with an X. You can also talk to the whole Rolled Spine gang on the Twitters at Rolled Spine. We hope you enjoyed our little program, and remember, spill the blood!